Hi, and a very warm welcome to this fourth episode of Taking the Fear Out of Cancer.
Good morning, good morning, welcome. And today I have an amazing guest with me. Her name is Kate Carruth. She's not only a copywriter, content alchemist, but a published author and so, so much more. Good morning, Kate.
Maureen, good morning. It's lovely to be here.
So this is another of my amazing episodes of Taking the Fear Out of Cancer. Now, your cancer experience goes back right back to 2006.
Yeah.
And obviously life has changed dramatically in that in the interim period. I wonder if you could share with my listeners your experience of from diagnosis onwards.
Right. Okay. I realise, even though I said it started in 2006, actually it started before that. I first started to notice pain in my breast in early 2005. I didn't do anything about it, which in one sense sounds foolish, but I've been told several times pain is not an indication of anything major. And I was doing a lot of running and just thought, oh, wrong bra. Changed my running bra, pain went, didn't think anything about it until I suppose would have been the November when I realized there was a lump. So that, like many people, that was the first indication I had that something really needed to be looked at. Saw the doctor, saw the GP in December and was referred at that point. She said to me, I was then 38. And she said to me, I'm sure this is nothing. You're far too young. It's very unlikely that this is anything serious, but I will refer you anyway, for which I am eternally grateful. Now, because it was just before Christmas, there was a gap because of obviously Christmas break and things like that. The standard at the time was you should be seen within 2 weeks. In fact, it was closer to four simply because of that sort of 2 week Christmas down period.
Sure.
And I had a mammogram on, it would have been the 16th of January. And it was a strange experience because right up to that point, it was everything's fine, nothing's a problem. I got to the hospital, I sat down and I burst into tears. So part of me knew that this wasn't nothing. Had the mammogram. The consultant said to me, I've been wrong before, but I'm 99% sure this is something. So immediate ultrasound, immediate needle biopsy, and told to come back on the Friday. Went back on the Friday. It was the 20th of January. It was my 39th birthday. The diagnosis was confirmed. I had another biopsy because they could see that there was something going on in the... when they'd done the ultrasound, they'd picked something up in the nodes in the armpit. And the surgeon just wanted to know whether she was just doing a surgery for the lump or whether she was going to take the nodes as well. They did a second biopsy and that showed up that there was node involvement as well. So they simply... when they did the surgery, which was the following week, I had a lumpectomy. So for those who are not in the kind of the cancer know, that's the removal of the lump, but not the removal of the whole breast. And what's known as an axilla node clearance. So the lymphatic system, which is a whole set of little nodes all the way through the body, are all interconnected. And if you find cancer in one set, by removing that set, it stops them. It's one of the ways that cancer can travel through the body is through the lymphatic system. So they removed that set of nodes. And that's obviously, that's where, that's a way of arresting that cancer product, that sort of cancer process. So that was the surgery, which happened the week later. You go back a couple of weeks later. I had the full results. Everything's taken away and tested, and it proved to be, it was a grade one cancer, so that means it's slow growing. So of the three grades, it's the slowest growing, but it was stage 3C. So in terms of the lymphatic nodes that they removed, nearly all of them were involved, and therefore technically it was one step from secondary cancer, so a step into vital organs, which obviously is much, much harder to deal with. So what the surgeon then said was, okay, so what we need to do is we need to make sure that this doesn't get another chance to get a foothold. So I was then put onto a path of chemotherapy, radiotherapy, and followed up by a whole series of drug therapies. So the cancer was proved to be hormone responsive, so estrogen responsive, which is a very common form of cancer in younger women. And so that meant a series of oral drugs for, it. At that point in time, it was done for 5 years. Nowadays, I think it's 10. So that was basically my 2006, was chemo, radiotherapy. I know that the last radiotherapy was something like the 30th of July. So from the 20th of January to the 30th of July, was that was basically my life. For those 6 to 8 months. And then you get the tamoxifen, which is the oral drug that they give you, and everyone says, okay, off you go, which is fine. So for the oncology people and for all of those, you know, the breast cancer nurses, it's like, okay, you're done, off you go, let's get on to the next person, which is as it should be for them. What it meant for me was I'm left blinking in the sunlight going, wait, now what? So what happens now? I'd had a long period of time, not quite off work. Work had been fantastic. They helped me out enormously by letting me do a job that I could do. So I wasn't just a person at home being sick, but at the same time wasn't too stressful for me, because at the time I was a management consultant, which is client facing, massively stressful. You're away from home. And that was deemed by their company doctor not to be appropriate for someone who was having chemotherapy, because I wouldn't be in a position to say, sorry, not feeling well today. But now I had to get back to work, get back to normal. And it was only probably about the March of 2007 that it kind of, I know it sounds a bit odd, but it kind of struck me that it had even happened. So you suddenly find yourself going, wait, did that just happen? That was real. That really happened, because treatment is, it's a process. It's like a machine. You show up every 3 weeks for chemotherapy. You show up every day for radiotherapy. You're seeing people all the day, all the time. You're the center of attention during that period of time. Everyone is, you know, within your family. And I've got quite a large extended family. We're all getting in touch. How are you doing? How's everything going? And then suddenly it all stops.
Yeah.
And for the rest of the world, it's back to normal. Not because they don't care. And actually, in some cases, as I realized later, it's because they need you to get back to normal. They need to think, it's fine, it's over. Kate's going to be okay now. And it's not normal at all. Everything has changed, and it's changed forever. So I suppose the next, particularly the next couple of years, I spent a lot of time not trusting my body, dealing with the side effects of the drugs that I was taking. So I was taking tamoxifen. I was fast tracking through the menopause. I mean, seriously fast tracking through the menopause. Chemotherapy followed by tamoxifen will basically kills the lot, and having a really tough time with that. I was tested at about 2 years on and was found to be fully menopausal. So they took me off tamoxifen and put me onto aromatase inhibitors, which are similar drugs but for postmenopausal women.
Okay.
At which point it turned out I wasn't fully menopausal, but it was induced by the tamoxifen. So I went back.
Crikey.
In other words, I did puberty again. I really, really do not recommend that. It was not at all fun.
Sheesh.
So, so I went back into premenopausal, at which point they said, look, it's really important that we get the estrogen levels under control because of the particular situation of your cancer. So they offered me a couple of options. One was to go back on tamoxifen, which I really didn't want to do because it had suited me so badly. Another was a monthly drug called Zoladex, which is a monthly injection, which I didn't particularly want to do. And the third was surgical intervention, so an oophorectomy. which is where they remove the ovaries. And that was what I elected to do, because I think I said at the time to the consultant, well, I'm not really using them. My relationship had come to an end during that period of time. So there was no question that I was going to want to have children. I'd never wanted to have kids anyway. So it wasn't as if I needed the ovaries for anything. And it was known to be the most effective way to deal with this kind of backwards and forwards with my estrogen levels. So yeah, so then I had the oophorectomy and did the menopause again. I am a world-class expert in hot flushes.
Love it.
Particularly hot flushes every 2 hours through the night.
Whoosh.
So I had quite a few challenges with sleep deprivation while doing a very challenging job back in consulting. So that was quite challenging. There were days where I would finish work at 5, go home, go to sleep 5:30 because I was so exhausted, and then wake up at like 2 in the morning because I obviously had my 8 hours and things like that. So I was having some very odd sleep patterns at the time. The aromatase inhibitors were giving me lots of joint pain. So I felt like I was 70. I was tired. It wasn't pain exactly. It was immobility. Everything was stiff. I couldn't hold a pen properly. I would stand up from my desk and my ankles wouldn't work properly. And it would take me a minute or two to get walking again. And I'd be hobbling about and things like that. So yeah, it was quite challenging.
Where are you now, Kate? So, I mean, we're now 2019. Mm-hmm. Given that you got the diagnosis on your birthday, of all days to get the diagnosis.
Yeah.
How has that played out for you over the years?
In all honesty, I don't think there's any good day to get a diagnosis. And you'll always remember that day and you'll always remember the date. It's trickier when it sits on your birthday because everyone's, you know it's coming in a way that you might be able to say, okay, well, that's the date, but I can forget about it. And every year for a long time, I mean, probably 10, 11 years, for a long time, as my birthday approached, there'd be this sense of gloom coming in over me, and I found it difficult to enjoy my birthday, particularly challenging. Everyone wants to make a fuss of you because it's your birthday, and in particular, of course, everyone in my immediate family in those first couple of years, they'd had to deal with the, oh my god, she might not be here much longer kind of thoughts in their own minds, and therefore there was that particular, let's make sure Kate has a lovely birthday. And the more fuss people made, kind of the harder it was to feel as I felt, which was, I just want this day to go away. I want to forget about it. I don't want it to happen. So I had 10 years of hating my birthday, if I'm honest. Really didn't like it, really didn't enjoy it, and tried lots of different ways to deal with that. I did going away for my 40th birthday. I spent in Egypt. So my friends took me to Egypt for my 40th birthday. And I did have that. That was a lovely birthday, because I was spoilt rotten, and it was seeing Egypt before I was 40 had been a life's ambition. So it was about, you know, getting that done. But for the next 9 years or so, I really didn't enjoy it.
Mm.
And you feel under pressure to be happy because it's your birthday, but somehow I didn't feel it. And then 2 years ago, so as I approached the 11th anniversary, it was a very strange thing. But as I was approaching the anniversary, I was walking into town where I now live, which is a beautiful walk through an old churchyard, but beautiful trees, birds singing, all of this kind of thing. Happened to be a lovely day. It was about 3 days before my birthday. And somewhere in my head, the thought popped up of, you know what? Sod this for a game of soldiers. I'm not going to be made miserable by this anymore. I'm done with it. And it was as sudden as that. So for 10 years, I've been carrying this thing around with me. This, I've had cancer. I'm, you know, my body's not perfect. My, trust it. This thing's going to go wrong. And then suddenly it was, I'm done. Which was really strange because I didn't expect it to be that kind of sudden. I thought it would be something that gradually over time I would get more, I would adapt to it and I would get used to it. And each year it would get easier. And then, but it wasn't, it was literally just done. I've had enough.
So what do you account for that?
A lot of things, actually. I'd started, let's think, so that was 2017. I'd started about 2 years before following a coach, working with a coach, and tackling a number of different aspects of my life. So looking much more at my health and what I was eating, partly because side effect of particularly tamoxifen is massive weight gain. And I needed to get rid of that weight to reduce risk of recurrence. So I'd done a lot of work on my health. I'd got to a point where I was no longer eating processed foods, really clean eating, really healthy eating. So my general emotional health was better. And it's the thing, when you start to eat healthily, yes, your physical health improves, but by God, so does your emotional health.
Yeah.
It was partly that. But also about my awareness of and recognition and tackling of my own kind of inner narrative. So the inner voice that we've all got had spent 10 years telling me it was coming back. And for eight and a half of those, I hadn't even really been aware it was there.
Mm.
Once I started to see it, once I started to change my perspective of my future, once I started to get rid of the toxic chemicals that come with processed foods that also twist your thoughts and distort everything, I started to get that kind of clarity of what was going on and being open to other voices. So when that voice came along and said, I'm done with this, I was ready to hear it.
Fantastic.
So it was a whole combination of all of those sorts of different things that were going on, a feeling that I was in control in a way I hadn't felt before. I'd felt that the world was happening to me rather than that I was happening to the world. But also in that that process of going through coaching, I had recognized for myself that I had other ambitions than to just be in the job that I was in. So I, as I mentioned before, I was a management consultant. I'd been doing it for 20 years. I was quite good at it, but it wasn't really what I'm here for. It wasn't what I was meant for. And I'd always known right from when I was tiny, I wanted to be a writer and had, for a number of reasons, had not done that because I thought I should get a proper job. I should do what other people expected of me. And through the process of working on myself, of coaching, of being asked the right sorts of questions, what would you do if you knew you couldn't fail? That was, to me, the pivotal question. What would you do if you knew you couldn't fail? I knew that I was going to quit my job, start my own business, and become a writer. And that became a pull forward. So somewhere in that progression, I think my inner voice, my kind of my consciousness said to me, you know what, if you really want to do this, if you want to run your own business, you haven't got time for all of this fear and darkness and hanging on to the past of cancer.
Yeah.
It's time to let it go. I've got too much else to do with my life and to do with the world than to be hanging on to something that happened, let's face it, over 10 years ago, which statistically, if cancer comes back after 10 years, it's not even the same cancer. It's a different one. So there was this element of, I've got no time for this anymore. Too busy. It's too much else to be doing. And there's too much to be had in that future to want to be clinging to that part of my past.
Yeah. And so you've now set up your own business, but earlier on you mentioned that there was an anticipation that everybody would just get back to normal immediately after the procedures and everything, after the process where you're wrapped up in cotton wool and you're looked after and everybody's looking out for you during that kind of, for you, 7 or 8 months. And then you also said not trusting your body. So do you trust your body now?
Yes. And I suppose what I mean by not trusting my body is, and from talking to other women, this is completely normal. So anyone who's listening to this who's in the early parts of their journey will probably be quite reassured by this. But every time you get a niggle that's more than a passing 5 minutes. So I had, I suppose, round about 10 months in, I pulled my elbow. My elbow was aching. And there's a part of you going, I wonder if that's in the bone. I wonder if that's cancer. Oh, there's a dark patch on my cheek. I wonder if that's melanoma. I don't feel very well. I wonder if it's cancer in the stomach, in the esophagus, and all of those sorts of things start to happen. And, of course, you're having very regular screening, mammograms, because I was taking estrogen suppressants. You have to have bone scans to check that the bone density is healthy. There's a whole range of these tests that keep popping up that you need to keep doing. And every one of them, you think, is it going to be something? Is it going to be something? Is it going to be something? And one of the... obviously I've been part of a number of different communities of people who have been going through similar things, and what comes up as a common theme all the time, which I think people who've not gone through this journey don't necessarily understand, and therefore when you say it to them they don't quite get it, waiting is the worst bit. And I can see it even when I was diagnosed. The time between the Monday when I had the mammogram and they said, I'm pretty sure that's something, and the Friday when they said, yes, this is definitely something, was the worst part of all.
Sure.
You can't tell anyone, but your whole life is on hold because you have no clue what's going to happen. And therefore, when on the Friday she said, this is cancer, this is what's going to happen, I actually felt relief. Because at least I had certainty. At least I knew what was going on. And that permeates all the way through. There's an uncertainty that this all produces in you. And every time you have a scan or every time there's a niggle or something doesn't look right or something happens, there's that what if, what if, what if. And the voice in your head going, not again, I can't do this again. I don't know how I can do this again. And these sorts of patterns repeat because, I mean, in a sense, I suppose it's a kind of post-traumatic stress. It is a massive thing to have to go through. And it's a massive shock to your system. You're rambling along in life, everything's okay. And then suddenly, wham, this happens and everything changes.
So you also mentioned that, about a year later, you questioned, did that actually happen?
Yes, not in a sense of unreality, but it was almost a kind of a, it was the first time that I truly accepted it.
Yeah.
So if you think, I don't know if you're familiar with the Kubler-Ross change curve. It's used and abused an awful lot in consulting as, you know, the kind of thing people go through when you do a change in an organization. But the original research is about people with things like terminal illnesses, deaths in the family, those kinds of things. And you go through these stages of shock and denial. And then you move into a space of acceptance where you suddenly go, okay, this is real. This really happened. And I think it was, that was almost what I'd come to is, okay, this was real.
Yeah.
This wasn't, you feel, I can't remember who the writer was. Someone described it as being tossed in a blanket. You can't really see what's going on. Everything's just happening.
Yeah.
And that's how it feels. And then at that point, suddenly there was a sense of reality that hadn't been there before, that it was really, and it was just me. Mm. I was just me. There wasn't anything magical on the outside somehow. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I can even explain it particularly well, but it was just like everything just sunk in.
I can definitely relate to that, Kate, because I had a not exactly similar, but very kind of comparable situation. Mm. So I finished my treatment in end of October 2017.
Yep.
And it wasn't until November 2018 when I was speaking at a conference in Spain, and I was asked to conduct the final session, which is a reflection session. And I sat at the front of the room with my co-host, lovely chap, Jonathan Shaddock, and my mind was blank. I thought, I've got nothing to contribute here.
Mm.
And then out of nothing, out of nowhere, I heard myself say, and I'm just glad to be alive. And it was at that point that it sunk in that there had ever been anything that I'd gone through that could have even remotely have ended my experience of life.
Mm.
But it took a year after treatment finished before I even got to that point. And it was the one and only point that I actually shed a tear over the experience. I haven't shed a tear since. I never shed a tear before. It was just in that instant, in that moment where I gave myself time to stop and think, that it came through. So yeah, I can truly relate to what you've been saying, even if we can't put the right words on it, because it's a very individualistic experience.
Yeah. Very, very individual. And just to qualify for anyone who's listening, who's thinking, oh, she didn't shed a tear. I shed loads. I cried the whole time. So, so we're at two ends of that spectrum.
Sure.
And anything in between and anything on the outsides of that is also absolutely fine.
Yeah.
And you kind of have to, you have to do what works for you. You have to go through it was one of the first things that somebody said to me when I was, I mean, probably, you know, 2 months after diagnosis, I'd just started chemo. And somebody said to me, you know, everybody's cancer is their own cancer.
Yeah.
Yours is not the same as whatever the kind of the scientists are saying about it's a stage this and a grade this and a this responsive and that. Everybody's cancer is different. It is their own, and therefore you have to have your journey and nobody else's.
And I think that's the point that I'm trying to make with all of these interviews, Kate, is that there is definitely no one size fits all with breast cancer or any other type of cancer. I think there's a misunderstanding for people that have never either been diagnosed with or known somebody who's been diagnosed with any form of cancer. There's a misunderstanding that the label breast cancer, kidney cancer, liver cancer, there's only one type of each.
Yeah.
Which is completely wrong. But also, even if you were, as you've just said, if I had had the same diagnosis as you, our experience would have been vastly different, because it's hugely personal, and it's how we as individuals receive the information, the diagnosis, and where we're at in life when that occurs.
Yep.
And
all sorts of circumstances,
So there is no one size fits all. And I think that's probably the biggest takeaway I want people to have, not just with you sharing this morning, but with all the various interviews I'm having with people around this whole topic of taking the fear out of cancer.
Yeah.
And it's, for me, it's about, because I'm taking the lid off the notion that you can have fear, you can have emotion, you can have experience of life. It's not that you're devoid of any of this. It's just taking the lid off it and exploring and allowing people to have that moment in time where they can. It's okay to talk about it. It really is okay to talk about it.
It's also, I mean, I suppose it's just sparked a thought in my mind. It's something else that's really that happened for me, and other ladies that I've spoken to with similar journeys, they found the same. Is that while you are being treated, and it was the thing that most took me by surprise the whole of that journey, was the level of responsibility you feel to other people. So the hardest thing for me was telling my parents, because I could imagine what it must be like when you're, what you see as a young, successful daughter comes to you and says, by the way, this is going on. That was extremely difficult because I knew how that it would strike them, particularly my dad, who has a tendency to really cared about his children, had a tendency to worry. So I knew he would be particularly anxious. But you feel this responsibility to other people. And therefore, you know, when I saw friends and family and it's, how are you? How are you doing? There's I'm doing fine. Everything's great. And you're being strong for them, and that's quite tough, but it's all part of the getting through it. And I think that moment sort of 18 months 15 months later, when it kind of that really happened, was also where I felt, okay, I don't need to be responsible for other people anymore. Now it's about me. And it was that switch around. And again, lots of people feel that, particularly women with children.
Sure.
Because there is that need for you not to really stress your kids out with what's going on and protect them from what might end up being quite harsh reality. So all of those sorts of things in that first year were part of the journey.
Yeah.
But I had the perspective as well of the wider world when I was diagnosed. So I was diagnosed about 4 months after Kylie Minogue.
Ah, okay.
So, of course, Kylie Minogue was doing exactly the same journey as me at broadly the same time. And it used to really wind me up in the media where they'd say, you know, sort of just after she'd finished chemo and was just starting to kind of come back into the public life. Successfully battled cancer, she's fine now, all of those kinds of messages, because I was listening to that and I'm thinking, no, she's not. I know exactly what she's going through because I'm going through it too. You're not fixed at the end of the chemotherapy. You're not better at that point. I mean, yes, you are in one sense, because the whole point with things like chemotherapy, radiotherapy, all those drugs is they just kill everything inside, so you're probably as cancer free at that moment in time as you'll ever be, but that's only thinking about the physical. It's not taking the mental and the emotional and the spiritual side of it all into account for a second.
Absolutely.
And that's the bit that the outside world, A, doesn't usually see, and B, kind of doesn't want, probably unfair to say they don't want to know about it, but it might not occur to them.
It's not
going on.
Yeah, it's not the most palpable side of it. So they see that somebody has gone through the various aspects of treatment, and whether there's any reconstruction happening. All of that is like the, as you say, the physical. But they're not ready for somebody to be in a heightened state of emotion or just not ready to face the world.
Yeah.
And that's the bit that people struggle with. I remember talking to my mother probably about a year after, and all she kept saying was, I kept taking my lead from you. And I forewarned my mother via my brother. So I actually had a conversation with my elder brother, who I hadn't spoken to directly for a number of years, but I actually was texting him a few days after I got the diagnosis to say, are you around? Because he actually works on the oil rig, so he's not always at home.
Yeah.
Are you around at the minute? Because I need to give my mother some news. So I actually told him first.
Yeah.
And he was going to visit her the next day so that at least he would be there, because I had no idea how she would receive the news.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until, like I say, a year later that she actually even mentioned to me that she was taking her lead from me. And because I seemed to be okay, which I was, that was the way she took it. I mean, yes, she's quite religious, so she did add me onto another layer of prayers at night and stuff, which is lovely, and it's all great stuff. But there is a sense of responsibility. Whether it's true or whether it's something that we feel we ought to do is a different matter. But there's definitely a sense, particularly around the close people around us, whether it's family, friends, colleagues, whoever you spend most of your time with, that you feel some level of deeper connection to, that there's a responsibility for. And like you say, around the Kylie Minogue story, which was great in a sense because there was a very public person, having such a diagnosis. But as you say, they were only reporting back on the physical side of things, the actual treatment having been completed, and not how Kylie was actually in and of herself. I mean, she may have been fine, she may not have been, but there's more to this, as you say, than just the physical, which I think isn't discussed enough.
And it's A, it's normal, and B, it's okay. And see, it's okay to share it.
Yeah.
And to say to people, yes, physically I am fine. I'm finding things difficult in some area. I mean, I was on drugs for 5 years that on and off, and various, you know, surgery and changing the drugs and all of those kinds of things, which were having an impact on me. Mm. And there weren't that many people I felt I could share that with.
Sure.
Again, to do with the kind of job that I did. Actually, they would have been fantastic if I had explained to work that this was what was going on for me. But I did find it incredibly difficult to say to people, do you know what? I just feel really, really emotional today. Yeah. And it's to do with the drugs. And you find it very difficult to share those kinds of things. And it's partly to do because you feel emotion, and therefore your self-worth can drop, you can feel a great deal of doubt about yourself. You find it much more difficult to then say to somebody, I feel a bit off today, whereas it would be quite easy to say to somebody, I feel really happy today, because of course all your confidence is with that. It is tied up in how you're feeling emotionally as well. So
is that one of the reasons why you started you contribute to the support group then?
Yes. So when I was diagnosed, I was living down in Kent, and there was a support group in Kent for women of working age who'd been diagnosed with breast cancer. And when I moved, so a year later, my relationship broke up for other reasons, nothing to do with the cancer. When my relationship broke up, I moved back to where I'd grown up in Suffolk. And there was no such group. There was a cancer support group, but it was a general support group for all people with cancer, all different types of cancer. Breast cancer, of course, is particularly one that is common with women under the age of 50. Mm-hmm. And there are different challenges if you are of working age, around employer reactions, around you may have small children who need to deal with what's happening. So I set up BBC One in Five, so Bury Breast Cancer, and one in five, because at the time that was the statistic, that was the number of women diagnosed who were under the age of 50. It's now many, many more than that. But that was why I set the group up. It's not, there's no specialist service involved. It's not counselling or coaching. It's just an opportunity for anybody who's been diagnosed to come along and talk to other people who've done it too. And being able to hear somebody else say, oh yes, that's normal. Anything from, I'm having this chemotherapy and it's having this effect. Just to have three or four people around you going, yep, yeah, that was me too. Felt exactly that way when it happened. Yeah. Don't worry about that drug, it makes you pee red. You know, all of those kinds of things. Anyone who's listening will go, oh yeah, epirubicin. But yes, there are certain drugs that have certain effects on you. And just having that kind of comfort of, it's okay, I'm not going nuts with those kinds of things. And then getting back to normal life. For the women with children of, I suppose, the 8 to 10 year olds, 8 to 10 year olds like to be the same as their mates. And therefore, when you're an 8 year old whose mum's lost her hair and mum is sick, it can be really important to have a friend whose mum has also lost their hair and is also sick. Those sorts of things we were able to do is just get people together, let them talk to one another. And some people come along once or twice for information. Some people come for a year or so and then say, okay, it's enough for me. I need to put that behind me. And some people, a couple of the people who joined at the very start of it, still members, come along, we get together, we look at how our lives are progressing, and we've just become friends over the years.
Yeah.
And we're there to help other people as they go through their journey.
That's phenomenally important service that you're offering there, Kate. So kudos to you for kind of setting that up. Mm. So as a final kind of closing point, is there anything, any kind of parting information, insights or ahas that you would like to share with the listeners?
I think for anyone who's listening to this, who's been recently diagnosed or has recently gone through treatment, I'm going to say to you what I say to anybody I meet who joins my support group. And that's, it's 13 years. I am healthy. I am happy. I am well. So while right now it can feel huge and scary, keep your eyes on the horizon, because there is a future to this. And in fact, some of the things that happened to me through that diagnosis were also some of the best things that happened to me. So that life's too short motto that people trot about in this very trivial way, that really means something. In that first year after I was diagnosed, I did a lot of things I had just been, one day I'll get round to. I saw Pompeii. I walked on Hadrian's Wall. I went to Egypt. I published my first book. All of those are positives that came out of that diagnosis. So find the positives, hard as it feels. Remember that there are people like me, like you, Maureen, who are out here living life and here to help as well. So it is the cancer survivor community. I hate the word survivor, but at the same time, it is, you know, it's a word that's used. The cancer survivor community is a community. We will help one another. We will step up to help somebody else as they join the worst club in the world. Mm. But 13 years.
Fantastic. Thank you ever so much for your time today, Kate. If anybody wants to contact you, what's the best way to do so?
So there is an email address for BBC One in Five. We are, Macmillan and some of the other cancer groups do actually have our contact details on there. But the email address is BBC1in5, and that's all words, @gmail.com.
Fantastic.
So you can ping me an email. I'm always happy to answer questions, have a chat with people. The actual support group is obviously a local group, but I'm more than happy to talk to people who just need to talk to somebody else who's gone through this journey.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Kate, for your time this morning. It's a delight as always to speak with you, and I look forward to speaking to you again very soon.
And thank you, Maureen, for all that you do and all that you're planning to do.
Thank you. And for my listeners, the next episode of Taking the Fear Out of Cancer will be following very shortly. Bye for now.